Hariom to all of you. Today we are supposed to do a summary of chapter 2, and this summary actually is based on a talk I gave during the Gita Jayanti, where we just summarize the gist of chapter 2. So we have actually gone through in detail, but many students say they still can't remember. So maybe this summary of chapter 2 will help to revive some memories. Okay, what I'm going to do is, we have stopped at verse number 66 last week. The next two verses, 67 and 68, I will discuss first, because they are connected to what we have been discussing. And then the last four verses of chapter 2, 69, 70, 71 and 72, I will take up with the summary of chapter 2. Okay, so let us look at verse number 67. And here we must remember that Krishna is speaking about the importance of mastery of the senses and mastery of the mind. That is what we have been discussing over the last few verses, and how important it is if we want to progress on the spiritual path, because the ultimate is we must gain the spiritual knowledge. And if we don't have a mastery of the senses and a mastery of the mind, this knowledge will not be attained by us. This is what Sri Krishna is trying to tell us, that you can only attain, you can only absorb this knowledge if you have some discipline over your senses and your mind. So in these two verses, 67 and 68, he is concluding that discussion about the mastery of the senses and the mind. And he gives us a beautiful allegory in verse number 67. So let us look at that verse. Here he says that Indriyanam means all the various five senses that we have. And when we say Indriya here, we are talking about the eyes, nose, ears, skin, tongue, etc. Okay? Indriyanam hi charatam. Indriyanam hi charatam means, the word charatam means wandering, because that is the nature of the senses. They are always like to wander. Eyes like to see some beautiful form, ears like to hear some nice music, and so forth and so forth. So the senses are continuously wandering. Now, if the senses wander according to my permission, it's not a problem. If I am in firm control, I decide where I want the senses to go, it's not a problem. But often it is the case that senses wander without our control. Like the example given as a grazing cow, which is just moving around, just eating the grass, it wanders wherever the grass is. That is our nature of the senses. And the problem with the senses wandering, he mentions in the second line of verse 67, when these senses are wandering, yan mana, the mind, mana, anuvidyate, pulls the mind along. As the senses keep on wandering, the problem is eventually they will also disturb that mind and they will pull it away also. And we know this because sometimes we are trying to sit down and trying to study the Gita, or we are trying to concentrate on something. But when we are unable to control our senses and the mind, and then what happens? We suddenly find ourselves somewhere else already. We have lost our concentration in what we are doing. So in the third line of verse 67, he says, so powerful are these wandering senses that tat asya harati prajna. Prajna means the end result is, when the senses wander and they pull the mind away, what do we lose? Krishna says, prajna means knowledge. Harati means it forcefully takes away your knowledge. So your capacity to attain knowledge is forcefully taken away by the wandering senses, which carry your mind also away. Thus, what is the loss of the spiritual seeker? The loss is you are unable to attain this knowledge. You are unable to listen. You are unable to retain. You are unable to focus on this knowledge. That is why repeatedly Krishna keeps on emphasizing that we must gain a mastery of this senses and the mind. And in order for us to understand better, he uses a metaphor in the last line of verse number 67. He says, supposing a person has a boat and I am the master of the boat. So when I sail my boat, I should decide which direction I want the boat to go in, isn't it? But supposing I sail the boat and I decide I don't care where the boat goes, then what will determine the direction of the boat? Two things. One is the wind and one is the current also. So here he says, the example he gives, Vayu means wind, Navam is a boat on the ambasi, on the water. Just like the wind pushes the boat away, which is sailing on the water. That is the nature he's comparing, how the senses can pull the mind away and eventually we lose knowledge. So, what is the wind representing here? What does the wind represent? Sorry?
Either
what? What does the wind represent?
Senses.
Because it is the senses that are pulling the mind into the direction they want. And the boat therefore represents the mind. Because it is the boat which goes off in the wrong direction. Just like our mind, led by the senses, goes off in the wrong direction. And therefore, what is the water representing? What does the water represent? Water represents water only. No, you see, example he is giving is a boat on the water. That is when the problem is created. Meaning what? When the mind itself is on unstable ground. You see? He doesn't say when the boat is secured in the harbor. Because when the boat is secured in the harbor, then nothing can change the direction of the boat. So here he's talking about a boat on turbulent water, and on top of that, the wind which pushes the boat in the direction it wants. So that means if your mind also is weak, it is not anchored properly with devotion, with knowledge, so you already have a troubled mind. That troubled mind is very easily, forcefully taken away by the senses. So that means two things we need. We need devotion to anchor the mind. We need knowledge also to anchor the mind. So he gives an example of the danger of the uncontrolled senses and the mind. And eventually he says that it takes away the prajnam or the knowledge. And he concludes this discussion in verse number 68. In verse number 68, he says, Tasmat, very important. Tasmat meaning therefore. What should we do? Therefore, he addresses Arjuna with the word Mahabaho, mighty arm. Again, very significant why he addresses Arjuna as mighty arm. Why do you think he addresses Arjuna as mighty arm? Which has a relevance to what he is trying to tell him in this verse also. Mighty arm.
To remind him he was a warrior.
Yes.
And to fight. That's what the problem is all about.
We're getting near to the answer.
Yeah.
So when a warrior has to fight, he's telling Arjuna, you are equipped with all the right weapons. You have come to the battlefield, you have practiced, you have come equipped with the right weapons. That means you are equipped to fight this battle. henceforth, a spiritual person also, if he wants to advance spiritually, he also has to equip himself with the discipline of the senses and the mind. So he's telling Arjuna, just like you are a mighty warrior, before you come to the field, you are well prepared with your weapons, with you have put in sufficient practice. So also a spiritual person cannot just take the spiritual part lightly. You cannot just leave it to chance. You also have to prepare yourself. You also have to discipline yourself. If your ultimate goal is spiritual knowledge, because you know that only spiritual knowledge can take you to moksha, in order to have attained spiritual knowledge, you need a disciplined mind. In order to get a disciplined mind, what should you do? Control your senses and your mind. Therefore, you have to prepare yourself, arm yourself well on this spiritual path. So he says here, therefore, Arjuna, sarvasa, all your sense organs, all your senses including your mind, sarvasa, all indriyani, your senses and your mind, nigrihitani, may you learn to master. Remember we discussed indriya nigraha, mano nigraha. The word nigraha means master. So here he uses the same word, nigrihitani. May you learn, may you equip yourself by mastering your senses, all your senses, not just one. That's why he uses the word sarvasa, meaning not just one. You don't think that you master one sense, you're going to get away with it, because any other sense also can pull you down. And also, it includes the mind. So, nigrihitani sarvasa indriyani. And he says, eventually, what happens? Indriyani indriyarteshu. Eventually, when the senses are completely restrained by this mastery, when you have achieved the mastery of the senses and the mind, what is the end result? The last line he says, tasya, only then, prajna, the knowledge, pratishtita, then only the knowledge will be well established in you. So we are given the benefit or the result of being able to master the senses and the mind. Therefore, if you feel that you are unable to absorb this knowledge, you are unable to retain this knowledge, what should you do? You know that where is your weakness lying. It is because you are unable to discipline your senses and your mind. These are the two very important disciplines, which Krishna concludes here in verse number 68. Tasya prajna pratishtita. Only then will the prajna, will the knowledge be well established. And there's another beautiful metaphor which was given by one Swamiji. He said, this is just like if you look at the example of a clock. You know, the amount of effort we have to put in. In the clock, there are three hands. The second hand has to rotate 60 times before the minute hand moves once. So 60 times the second hand has got to work. The minute hand will just move once. Then the minute hand has got to go around the whole face of the clock 60 times, and the hour hand will just move once. So what does this mean also to us on the spiritual path? This second hand, the minute hand and the hour hand, what allegorically Swamiji was trying to explain, that the second hand are our actions. We cannot expect to achieve overnight mastery of the senses and the mind. That means we have to put in a lot of effort in our actions to discipline our senses and our mind. And when we say mastery of senses and mind, what do we mean? What do we mean by mastery of senses and mind? Mastery is never suppression, because if you suppress your senses and your mind, it is going to explode somewhere. Therefore, mastery does not mean suppression. At the same time, mastery does not mean expression. But when we say mastery, means what? Diverge. You can only gain mastery of your mind and senses by diverting. Hence, we have been given so many type of spiritual practices. There are multiple type of spiritual practices. There are multiple types of devas also. Whatever appeals to you, whatever worship appeals to you, whatever type of sadhana appeals to you, take that up. The reason is all these various sadhanas are designed to help us to divert the senses and the mind. So much of action, so much of sadhana we must do, that is represented by the second hand, and therefore the minute hand will move once. The minute hand is what? So much of actions you must do, so much of effort you must put, so much of sadhana, then only your mind gets a little bit purified, right? Because it's not going to happen overnight. You have a lot of what we call impurities in the mind. So it is not going to go away overnight. A lot of sadhana we do, the mind will turn a little bit purer. Then the mind is represented by the minute hand. So much of purity the mind has got to undergo, and then the hour hand represents the then only your life will turn in the right direction, isn't it? So much of effort you put, purify the mind. So much the mind gets purified, then your life will turn in the right direction. So we can see this allegory by the clock itself. So tasya prajna pratishtita, then only the knowledge gets established. And we can also use another example when we think about this. You put a piece of paper and the sunlight is shining on the paper will not burn. But if you take a magnifying glass and focus it on the paper, the sunlight will burn the paper. That means what? With this mastery of the mind, when the knowledge is absorbed in you, then the knowledge will be useful to you. It will be absorbed in you, you will be able to apply it. It will be very focused, your mind will become single-pointed. So thus here in verse number 68, Krishna ends the discussion about the mastery of the senses and the mind. In the last four verses, he is going to summarize about the sthita prajna, but I will take this up now when we do the what we call the summary of the whole chapter 2. Okay? So let us look at the summary of the chapter 2. Okay. In any journey that we undertake, we might not have time for question and answers. So if you all come with some questions, then we'll take it up in next week. Huh? In any journey that we undertake, there are three very important components. One is, what are the three important components? Any journey that you undertake, whether worldly journey or spiritual journey. Destination, where you want to go. How are you going to get there? And you, the traveler, right? The traveler, the destination, and how you're going to reach the destination. So chapter 2 is the capsule of the teachings of the Gita, and it also addresses for us these three questions. What is the destination of our spiritual journey? Who is the traveler? And how is the traveler going to reach that destination? And this question, if we look at verse number 54, we will understand, because this is the same question that Arjuna has asked Lord Krishna. After hearing the whole discourse from Krishna, here in verse 54, Krishna asked this question. Sorry, Arjuna asked this question. He says, what is the transformation? If I go through all the sadhanas that you have spoken about, Krishna, you have talked about karma yoga, you have talked about jnana yoga. If I follow all the sadhanas that you have prescribed, what will be the change in me? What will be the transformation? And Arjuna uses the technical word here, sthita prajna. Prajna meaning, again, knowledge. Sthita meaning one who is firmly established in this knowledge. So once I have absorbed this knowledge, what will be the change in me? Can you please tell me what is the nature of this Sthita Prajna? Kim Prabhaseta, how does he speak? Kim Asita, how does he sit? Kim Rajeta, how does he walk? So what here Arjuna is trying to ask is, how does this Sthita Prajna interact with the world? When he moves about with the various objects, possessions that he has, with the various different types of people he meets, and also with the various situations he experiences in life. Because the Sthita Prajna is not one who has isolated himself, but one who is moving about in society. And we also have to understand, just because you become a Sthita Prajna doesn't mean all the problems go away. Because it is just like this. When you started coming from Gita, when you started coming for Gita classes, so many classes you came, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, the world is remaining the same, isn't it? Before you came for Gita class, the world is like that. After you come for Gita class, the world is also going to be like that. So what has changed? We have changed. So Vedanta is never giving us knowledge how to change the world. The world will remain as it is. What Vedantic knowledge is giving us is how to face that same world, those situations, those how to deal with our possessions, how to deal with various experiences in life. So here, this is what Arjuna wants to know. Give me a benchmark, give me the qualities of a Sthita Prajna, so at least I know what is my destination. I will know when I reach my goal that what are the marks of a Sthita Prajna. Okay. What does Krishna say? If we look at these two verses, verses number 69 and 70, Krishna uses an allegory to explain the nature of a Sthita Prajna. What is the nature of a Sthita Prajna in verses 69 and 70? So what does he say? Krishna says, now, one thing we must understand, that as I said earlier, when we talk about Sthita Prajna, we can use different terminology. So here the word Sthita Prajna, you might find in some other texts, it is also called as a jnani, means one endowed with the knowledge. So we can use any term, Sthita Prajna, we can use jnani, or some of the texts call this person a Jivan Mukta, one who is free of the shackles of life. Right? So no matter what it is one and the same person, different terms used. And therefore, what is the opposite of a Sthita Prajna? We can take the term as Ajnani. Jnani is one endowed with knowledge, Ajnani is one who does not have the knowledge. And remember, both the Jnani and the Ajnani face the same world. Not that because you are a Jnani, you face a different world. It is the same world. So here in this verse, Krishna is giving a comparison between a Jnani and an Ajnani. How do they interact with the world? And he uses a metaphor. He says, that which is night, the word Nisha here, N-I-S-A, Nisha means night. That which is night to the man of wisdom, here he uses the word Samyami. Samyami means the same thing, Sthita Prajna, Jnani, the one who is endowed with wisdom. That which is night to all people, that is the word Sarva Bhutana. Sarva Bhutana means all the people. To those people which is night, to the man of knowledge, he keeps awake. So when everybody is sleeping, the Jnani is awake. That is allegorical. Okay. Then in the next two lines he says, and when the Bhutani, that means all the people, are Jagrati, when they are awake, when they see morning, what does the Jnani see? he sees darkness, he goes to sleep. So who is your jnani? Who is your jnani? At night, that means now night you must stay awake, morning you go to sleep, you become a jnani. So what is the allegory here, we must understand. The word here for jnani also is used as muni. Muni translated in the English text here, I think they use the word sage. But actually what is a muni? Muni means one who has focus on the highest goal in life, that is moksha. That is a muni. Who is not concerned about the growth in artha and kama, but whose one goal in life is to attain moksha. So muni is not just a sage, but one who has a very sharp intellect, a very sharp goal, what he wants to achieve in life, spiritual goal. So what it means here is that, excuse me, that which is night, here night means what? Darkness. And darkness is what rajasic and tamasic people are attracted to. So the kind of places that rajasic and tamasic people are attracted to, the kind of company they like to keep, the kind of materials they like to read, or the type of movies they like to see. To a jnani, he sees only darkness. But to the others, they see brightness, they see light, they run towards all this. And where the jnani sees brightness, where does the jnani see brightness? Going for satsangs, going for bhajans, going for spiritual talks, reading the right type of materials, spiritual materials, the rest of them only see nothing but darkness. They stay away from it. So this is also a way for us to assess what are the type of friends we are attracted to, what are the places we are attracted to. You know, like the English saying says, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. Where wise people see danger, they stay away from it. They see a group of people gossiping, they know these people only like to gossip. Then you, what do? You stay away from it. Why do you want to go and involve yourself with these people? So the type of materials you like to read are spiritual things. When you hear, when you mix around with people, like-minded people, satsang. That's why we say, that's where a jnani sees brightness. But if you tell other people, they tell you, you are wasting your time. Why are you going for Gita classes? Waste of time. Let's go shopping. So where people see brightness, the jnani sees nothing but darkness. And where the jnani sees brightness, others sees nothing but darkness. So we have to evaluate also what are the things that attract us also, right? So here is just a metaphor that he's using. Then in the next verse, he again uses another metaphor. This time the metaphor that he uses is Samudra. Samudra is the ocean. And what is the glory of the ocean? What is the glory of the ocean? What is the greatness of the ocean? It's vast, it's deep. What else?
And absorbs everything.
The ocean is much
absorbs everything. What? The ocean?
The ocean can be calmer than the sea.
The ocean is calmer than the sea. See, the two most important things about the ocean is it is always purnatvam, isn't it? It always maintains its balance. Even the rivers keep on pouring tons and tons of water into the ocean never overflows. So one of the qualities of the ocean that is compared to a jnani, his mind of the jnani is purnatvam, always steady, always full. That means he is always in a state of happiness. Similarly, the ocean also is always purnatvam. And this purnatvam, we must understand the beauty of the ocean's fullness, is independent of anything else. It does not depend on anything else to remain full. So the second beauty of the ocean is called swatantaram. Swatantaram means it is independent. Its happiness or fullness is not dependent on any other factor. And then of course you will say, that is not true. Why? The rivers bring the water to the ocean. How can you say the ocean is not dependent on any other factor? To remain full, it depends on the river to bring water to it. Right? See, I'm going to ask you questions because you're not asking. So, if you say that, because the river, the ocean is full, then the question will be asked, where did the river water come from? From the ocean, isn't it? The ocean evaporates the water to the clouds, the clouds rain down to the mountain carries the water down to the river, and river flows back into the ocean. So, rivers are dependent on the ocean, but ocean is never dependent on the river. Therefore, it is always Purnatvam and it is Swatantaram. It does not depend on anything to be full. Second glory of the ocean. One is rivers bring water to it, it never overflows. Second glory of the ocean, the sun shines down on the ocean, evaporates so much of water throughout the day, gallons and gallons of water of the ocean is evaporated, yet the ocean remains the same. That is again Purnatvam. So that means whatever it receives, it remains Purnatvam. Whatever it gives up, it remains Purnatvam. Now compare that nature of the Samudra to the nature of a Jnani. Meaning what? Whatever the Jnani receives, it doesn't make any difference to his happiness. Why does it not make any difference to his happiness? He has already discovered the fullness within. He has already discovered the peace within. The highest peace he has discovered. What more can you give a Jnani? A simple example is, if I am a billionaire, billionaire, and you come and give me 1,000 ringgit, is it going to make me any more happier? What is 1,000? You give me 10,000 ringgit, what's the difference? Because I'm a billionaire, 10,000 is not going to make any difference to my life. And if I lose 100,000 ringgit, it is also not going to make any difference to me. So similarly, a Jnani, because of the Purnatvam that he has discovered, whatever extra he receives does not get him carried away, does not throw him into ecstasy, because he has already reached that highest level of ecstasy which he has discovered within. At the same time, whatever he loses, just like the sun evaporates the waters of the ocean, whatever he loses also does not trouble him, because again he has discovered that Purnatvam within. So this is the nature of the Jnani that Krishna is describing in verses 69 and 70. Now the question is, how do we start this journey? How that Sthita Prajna is a far off goal, but how do we start now? What are the qualities that we must have in order to start this spiritual journey? So for that, we must go back to verse number 7. In verse number 7, which is a very famous verse in the Bhagavad Gita, which is called the surrender verse, and we can use this verse as a prayer verse to recite to Lord whenever we are lost, whenever we are confused. So this is a very beautiful verse also. You can learn to recite it. Karpanya Dosho, a very famous verse. Here in this verse, Arjuna exhibits the two very, very important qualities for any person who wants to start the spiritual journey. And the first quality, you can see the word in the last line of verse 7, the last word, prapana. Prapana means surrender. Or you might find other words in the text called saranagati, surrender. The first quality that a seeker must have is surrender. And this surrender must not be a half-hearted surrender. Right? It must be a total surrender with faith. And what do you mean by faith? Adi Shankaracharya defines faith as having faith in the Guru and in the words of the scriptures. I have total faith in the Guru He will lead me to the right path, and I have total faith in the words of the scriptures. What the scriptures are telling me are not wrong. If I cannot understand who is wrong, it is my understanding which is wrong. So that is what is called faith. And it is with faith that you will come to experience. Because experience is very, very far away. Until we get to be a realized person, it's a very long journey. But if you don't have faith, you can't even start the journey also. So that surrender must be total. It must be 100%. And I have told you the story about Ramakrishna Paramahansa, who was diagnosed with cancer. If you recall the story, what it means when we call surrender. Ramakrishna Paramahansa was a great devotee of Ma Kali. And many people used to go to him when they had problems, they had health problems, they had so many type of problems. And he used to pray to Ma Kali and their problems be removed. So when he was diagnosed with throat cancer, his disciple Swami Vivekananda asked him, "Swami, you have prayed to Ma Kali and you have removed so many people's problems. Why can't you appeal to her, pray to her, and your throat cancer will be removed within a second? Why don't you do that?" And Ramakrishna's answer was, "When I have surrendered everything to Mother, this body, this mind, everything I've given over to her, how can I ask it back from her? Everything belongs to her. She can do whatever she wants. I have totally surrendered it to her. I am not going to ask it back. Because once you go and give somebody something, then how can you even ask it back from that person?" So that is called total surrender. So first quality is prapanam. Do we have that attitude of surrender? And what is the second quality, which is also demonstrated by Arjuna in this verse? The second quality is in line number 3 or verse 7, you see the word Shreya. Because many people go to Guru and surrender, but what do they surrender for? Help me win lottery ticket, help me pass my exam, help me get a better job, better promotion. We are surrendering for what purpose? For prayers, that is called prayers, the material good, the immediate good. We want immediate returns. Prayers is immediate good, material good. But what did Arjuna surrender for? Not prayers, but Shreyas. What is the difference between prayers and Shreyas? Shreyas is ultimate good. Prayers is immediate good. I want the result now. Whereas Arjuna said, "Lord, don't tell me about winning this war and all that. That is not what I want. I don't want the comfort of the palace. I don't care whether I win or lose this war. But tell me what action I should do that will be for my ultimate good." Example given, if a student is studying for an exam which is 6 months away or 3 months away, the student doesn't want to study, but he, what you call, wastes his time by watching some movies, and he goes shopping, or he goes around what do you call the term lepaking with friends and all that. Now that is called Shreyas. That is immediate good. I can enjoy immediately. I can enjoy the immediate good. That is called Shreyas. Sorry, prayers. Prayers. I'm just testing whether you're awake. Okay. So that is called prayers. Immediate good. But father tells the son, "Son, you better study. You better sacrifice your time. If you study, you will get a good degree. You get a good degree, you get a good job, you will get money, you will enjoy." So that becomes what? Shreyas. That is your ultimate good. So we sacrifice immediate good for ultimate good. So what we surrender for also is very important. Surrender must be there, but surrender for Shreyas, not for praise. Okay, when Arjuna surrendered, these are the two qualities. Third quality also very important. And what is the third quality which also Arjuna exhibited again is in verse number 9. And that is the word, in the Sanskrit verse number 9, you look at the last line, the word called tusmim. Tusmim means what? Silent. When you surrender, then you have to be silent. Why must you be silent? So that you can receive the knowledge. That means you are saying, Krishna, now I am ready to listen. What was Arjuna doing in chapter 1? Babbling and babbling and babbling away. Where Krishna has got time to talk to him? Now he says, silent. Which means what? I have totally surrendered to you. Now I am ready to listen to what you have to say. So third quality is remain silent and listen. And then when Arjuna surrenders with honesty, with humility, surrenders for Shreyas and remains silent, what does Krishna do? Prahasan, he smiles. Why does the teacher smile? You see in verse number 10, second line, Prahasan, Krishna smiled. Why does he smile? Finally, student has surrendered, isn't it? He's ready to listen at least. So, teacher also feels happy. And because, you see, you must understand one thing. Vedantic knowledge, the knowledge of the scriptures in those days, the gurus never went door to door knocking on people's door. No, do you want Gita class? Do you want Gita class? You know? It is when people came to the Gurukul, bowed down with humility and honesty and requested for knowledge, meaning I really want the knowledge, then the teachers imparted. So here Krishna is glad to see that Arjuna is prepared to surrender and is prepared to receive. And also, why Krishna smiles? Because a teacher should be ready, cheerfully ready to impart knowledge when the student is ready also. The teacher should not grudge and grumble and say, now you surrender in the middle of the battlefield, where am I going to give you Gita knowledge now? Come to my ashram, then I'll give you. But surrender with smile, ready to help the lost soul. So, what is the very first thing now? Student has surrendered, teacher is ready to impart knowledge. The very first knowledge that Krishna imparts to Arjuna is in verses 11 to 25. And that is called Atma Jnana, the knowledge of the self. So, first knowledge that Krishna imparts is from verses 11 to 25, which is self-knowledge. The reason is that in this world, there are only two entities according to the scriptures. The two entities are, what are the two entities in this world? The whole world is made up of only two components. One is perishable and one is imperishable. And in Bhagavad Gita also, this perishable is called as apara prakriti. Prakriti means nothing but what we call matter. Apara prakriti means lower matter or lower prakriti. In chapter 7, Krishna uses these words. And the imperishable is identified as para prakriti, the higher nature. And you can also consider this as matter and this as consciousness. Or you can also say that this is what some sages say, body-mind complex, the body, the mind, the intellect, this whole body, and this is called Atma. In fact, for this body-mind complex, the scriptures use the technical word, they call it Anatma. So you can see that in reality, whatever terminology you can use, in reality there are only two components. And we are a mix of both. So we should know, therefore, which is the matter and which is the consciousness. In order to know that, we must get self-knowledge. So the verses from 11 to 25, Krishna gives self-knowledge. What must self-knowledge lead to? You get self-knowledge, then what must it lead to? What's your religion? First of all, before realization, you get self-knowledge. Now you're getting self-knowledge. Then what must you do?
Practice.
Self-inquiry. You have to use the knowledge to inquire now. What is matter? What is consciousness? Which is Atma? Which is Anatma? So, self-knowledge must lead to self-inquiry. When you spend sufficient time on self-inquiry, then it will lead to self-realization. So, first of all, we must gain self-knowledge. And how does Krishna describe the nature of Atma? He gives the nature of Atma, he gives the nature of matter also. So, if you look briefly through these verses, for example, you look at verse number 12, he uses again a very poetic language. He says, never was there a time when I was not there, not you, nor you, nor these people on the battlefield, nor will there be ever a time hereafter when we shall all cease to be. So obviously this is referring to what? It cannot be the body, because we know the body is going to go one day. So this refers to the nature of the Atma. And what is the nature that Krishna is referring to? In technical language, it is called Nitya. It is eternal. That is the first quality of Atma. We know this body is not eternal. We know nothing in creation is eternal, because everything has got to go. But Krishna is saying there is something that existed before your body came into existence. There is something that exists now along with your body. And when this body drops, this will carry on to exist. So one quality of Atma is Nitya. And when we say Nitya means, we must understand it is not subject to time. Whereas this body has got a birth date, has got a date of birth and a date of departure. Whereas Atma, you don't celebrate birthday of Atma, because Atma is eternal. So that's the first quality. Then we look at verse number 13. Here he uses two words here. The first word he uses is Dehino. You see in verse number 13 the word Dehino. And then at the end of the first line you see the word Dehe. So there is a Dehino and there is a Dehe. The Dehe is this matter, body, mind complex. The Dehino is the Atma, which is in the body-mind complex. So he says, what does he say about this? The second quality about comparing the Atma with the body is that the body is the one that changes through childhood, that goes into youth, that becomes old age. If you don't believe it, please look at your photographs. And he says, while the body is changing, yet there is something that is changeless. There is a substratum that supports this whole thing, but it does not change. And not only that, when the body falls, what happens to the Atma? It merely occupies a new body. So it does not change while the body changes, and then it takes up a new body, and then also Atma never changes. It remains one and the same. That is the second quality. Verse number 16. Verse number 16, he talks about another quality of Atma, that it is independent existence. It does not depend on the body for existence. The body depends on Atma. Atma does not depend on the body. Now, one important thing that we can understand from this is, if you say Atma is consciousness, body is matter, why is the body conscious? Matter has got no life, right? We all know this table has got no life, this bottle has got no life. This body is made of five elements, ether, air, fire, water, earth. They also have no life. How come the body then is moving? Why are the hands moving? Why is my mouth speaking? Why am I eyes seeing? So, Adi Shankaracharya gives us a beautiful example of the fire, a boiling pot, a pot and water. The nature of water is cold. But when the fire is applied to the pot, what happens to water? It gets hot. It gets hot not because of its own nature, but because it borrows the heat from the fire. Similarly, Atma is the nature of consciousness. It is alive. It has got life in it. When it occupies the body, therefore, it lends its consciousness to the body. And therefore, at time of death, even though the body is there, it cannot move. Because why? Consciousness has left the body. So, Atma is not dependent on the body, but the body is dependent on Atma. That is what he is trying to explain in verse number 16. Verse number 17, he gives another quality, Sarva Gata. He compares the body to be what we call all pervading. Meaning, while the body is restricted by space, we can only be in one place at one time, whereas Atma is compared always to the space, which means space is everywhere. It is inside this bottle, is the same space, outside the bottle is the same space. The same Atma which is in you is the same Atma which is in me, is the same Atma which is in everything in creation. So there are no, you don't have a separate Atma, I don't have a separate Atma. It is all one and the same. So he compares Atma to space. It is all pervading. It is not subject to restrictions of space. Then in verse number 19, one more quality he gives, that Atma is akarta abhokta. This Atma, although it's in the body, it does not dictate your actions. What you do, what you think, whatever actions you perform, the Atma is a silent witness. It merely gives you the consciousness to act. But what you decide to do with this mind-body, it depends on you. Therefore, since Atma is a silent witness, it is called akarta, the non-doer. At the same time, because it is the non-doer, it is also a bhokta. It does not get any papam punyam. Therefore, when you do Atma Shanti prayers, who are you doing Atma Shanti prayers for? Who is us? You are not doing for Atma. We call it Atma Shanti prayers. But actually, you can't give Shanti to Atma. Why? It's already a Shanti. So, you are... What are you doing Atma Shanti prayers for?
For ourselves.
That means for ourselves. Meaning what? The subtle and the causal body which is travelling. That carries the papam and the punyam. That is what you are doing Atma Shanti prayers for. Right? But we call it Atma Shanti prayers. So, Atma is neither the doer, neither will it experience the papam punyam. It is we, the mind, the subtle body and the causal body which travels to take another body and experience papam punyam. How do you experience papam punyam? Through all experience of sukha dukha. Whatever papam is experienced through dukha, whatever punyams you have is experienced through sukha. So, these qualities are all given up to verse number 25. Now, having given all these qualities of Atman to Arjuna, in verse number 29, Krishna must have seen the bewildered look on Arjuna's face. What is this fellow talking about? Atman, Atman and all that. Like now I see your bewildered faces also. So, it is not easy to grasp this knowledge. Because we, from the day we were born, we were taught to love one thing. What were we taught to love? In fact, you were not even taught to love. You automatically fell in love with this body. Isn't it? Right? And therefore, from the time you were born, you have been pampering this body and you consider yourself this body. So now somebody comes and tells you, you are not the body, you are Atman. Then it's not easy for us to grasp. So Krishna uses the word here in verse number 29, Ascharya. This knowledge of Atman, to most people, it is like something of a wonder, you know, like a magician pulling a rabbit out of the hat, you know. You are very surprise, you know, what is this knowledge of Atman? Is this my real identity? So, when a lot of people, he says, look upon this, Pashyati means to look upon this Atman as something of a wondrous nature, something of a mythological nature. Maybe it exists in the books, but does it really exist? And many people also, he says, Vadati, they talk about Atman, you know. Everybody talks about Atman, Atman this, Atman Shanti Praya, Atman this, my Atma, your Atma. But how many people believe that there is such a thing called Atma? And when you are talking about Atma, what are you talking about actually? What are you speaking about?
Consciousness.
What is this consciousness? You are talking about yourself, your real identity, not about somebody else. It is your, the way you are talking about Atma, like something far away, sitting somewhere, listening to your prayers, like Bhagavan. It is nothing but you, your consciousness that you are talking about. So, yet he says many people talk about it like it's something very of a marvel. And other people, he says, Srunoti, they hear, they go for so many satsangs, they hear Swamiji saying, your Atman, your Atman, your Atman, then they go out, they forget everything. Isn't it? So, what Krishna is trying to say, this knowledge about Atman is not easy to grasp. That means what? We have to spend a lot of time to read the scriptures. Until this knowledge is firm in us, we cannot just read it once a week and we absorb the knowledge. So you have to be very dedicated, very serious to this knowledge. But the question is, in order to absorb this knowledge, as we discussed earlier, you need a purified mind. So how do I get a purified mind? This is what Krishna now is going to explain. The second sadhana, the first sadhana was Jnana Yoga sadhana, which he explained from verses 11 to 25. And Jnana Yoga sadhana, you must remember, involves three stages. The three stages are very, very important if you want to progress in Jnana Yoga sadhana. The first one is called Shravana, which means you must constantly listen and listen and listen to this knowledge. It is not easy to grasp this knowledge. It takes years and years also just to understand what is this Atma. Then, after listening, you must engage very much in manana. This is very, very important, that is reflection. Keep on questioning, reflecting. Keep on asking yourself, what is this knowledge about? What is the truth of this knowledge? Manana. And then only you will come to Nididhyasana, which is meditation. So, this is Jnana Yoga. The path of Jnana Yoga, which was explained to Arjuna in verses 11 to 25, which you can also call as Atma Dhyan or knowledge of the Atma. So now Krishna says, it is not easy for us to absorb this knowledge. So what do you do? He says in verse number 39. If you look at verse number 39, he says, now I have given you the wisdom of Jnana Yoga, but it is not easy. So how do you prepare yourself for Jnana Yoga? Krishna says, now I am going to speak to you about the second sadhana, which is called Karma Yoga. So, first of all, we must all start with Karma Yoga, purify the mind, come to Jnana Yoga, gain knowledge, do meditation, and then gain moksha. So, what is the spiritual path? Start with Karma Yoga and purify the mind. With the purified mind, come to Jnana Yoga. With Jnana Yoga, attain knowledge. With knowledge, undertake meditation. With meditation, gain moksha. That is the pathway which is described in the Vedas, which is given also in Bhagavad Gita. So now, from verses 40 to verse number 50, Krishna will speak about Karma Yoga. What is the definition of Karma Yoga? And Karma Yoga, as I explained to you last time, is that it has two words, Karma and Yoga. So Karma means taking up the right action. Karma means following the right action. When we say right action, means doing all your duties. Your duties constitutes right action. Do not abandon your duties. Do not give up the duties. And all of us have different duties which we must perform. Now, I'm not going to elaborate too much on this because the next chapter 3 is totally about Karma Yoga. We are going to go in depth into the concept of Karma Yoga. But briefly, you must understand what is Karma Yoga. So, karma is right action. Yoga is right attitude. Because even if you do the right action and you have the wrong attitude, that is not Karma Yoga. Let me give you a simple example. If I donate 100 ringgit. Action is correct, but my attitude is I must make sure everybody knows that I donated 100 ringgit. So I announce to everybody, I am donating 100 ringgit. So that means what? My attitude is of ego. That is not karma yoga. It is karma, but not karma yoga. Similarly, somebody donates 5 ringgit, quietly goes and put in the altar and just walks away. That is called karma yoga. Because I do it as a duty. So right action must be accompanied by a right attitude. So two very important words that we must know about karma yoga. One is given in verse number 48. If you look at the last line of verse 48, how Krishna defines karma yoga? Samatvam yoga uchate. Verse 48, last line, samatvam yoga uchate. Yoga means this path of karma yoga, uchate, is defined as samatvam. Samatvam means what? Equanimity. With an equanimous mind, I do my duties. When I say with an equanimous mind means what? Even though I am doing my duty with the right attitude, yet the result can be favorable, the result can be unfavorable. That is not in my control. Because there are many factors that can determine the outcome of my actions. As we discussed, it is also your past karmas that can affect your action also. So, samatva means I must have that equanimous attitude. When I receive something favorable, what is it? Prasadam from God. It is the grace of God that I have got something favorable. When I receive something unfavorable, it is also the prasadam of God. So I don't categorize anything as favorable and unfavorable. I look upon every result as a prasadam. So my mind is samatvam. It is not disturbed through favorable and unfavorable situation. That is a right attitude to cultivate. Surrender the results to God. Not surrender the action to God. Surrender the result to God. Samatvam yoga uchate. What is the second definition of karma yoga? In verse number 50, last line again. Yoga karmashu kaushalam. Yoga is skill in action. Yoga is not just simply doing any action you call is right action. Therefore, you must have skill in action. Meaning, how can I convert my action into prayer, into worship? Now, I gave you the example of cobra poison. You remember? Cobra poison can be deadly if the cobra bites you. At the same time, cobra poison also is used to make antidote, which can also save you. So, same action, if I know how to convert the action into worship by surrendering everything to God with an attitude of surrender to God, and that's why I explained to you all, I'll explain, in Karma Yoga when we come to chapter 3, if you have that attitude that every action, you remember I asked you, what is the definition of prayer? How do you define prayer? That's why we need a lot of revision classes. You remember how we define prayer? Okay, let me give you an example. I am sitting in front of an altar. I am offering flowers to Lord, chanting the mantras. My mind is in Switzerland. Is that prayer? I am eating my food. I am thanking the Lord for giving me this food. Is that prayer?
Yes. Right.
So how do you define prayer? Where my mind is, not where I am physically at. Okay, now take that concept and bring it into your everyday life. If I'm at the workplace, how do I turn my work into worship?
By offering your
think about God while you're doing your work. You're surrendering everything to God. So you're not working because of this company, or you're not working for this person or that person. You have to surrender in your mind. You can only do it mentally. You surrender the action to God, you surrender the result to God. So whatever I do throughout this day, whatever favorable happens, unfavorable happens, I accept it as your prasad. Similarly, when I'm cooking in the house, who am I cooking for? Family will always complain, food is salty, food is too much spicy, too little spice. But who am I cooking for? For God. Therefore, every act becomes an act of worship. Right? So it is not where you physically are. Your temple, your kitchen becomes a temple, your office becomes a temple. Why? Because your attitude is of surrender to God. And when you surrender all the results to God, whatever happens, you find that you are not disturbed. Your mind is calm. So this is called Yoga Karmashu Kaushalam, learning how to convert all your actions into worship. Your work becomes worship. So that's why he says yoga is skill in action. Now I think I need another 10 minutes. Are you all okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So now he has explained the path of Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga, and then Arjuna asked him the most important question, which we came to in verse 54, the marks of a Sthita Prajna. So if I'm on this path of Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, how do I ensure that this knowledge is totally absorbed in me? And for that, Krishna said, the two important disciplines that you have to practice are? Indriya Nigraha and Manu Nigraha. Discipline of the senses and discipline of the mind. Which he explained to Arjuna from verses 58 up to verse number 68 that we have discussed. Mano Nigraha and Indriya Nigraha. The discipline of the mind and the senses is very important if you want to receive the maximum value of this knowledge. The knowledge can only be absorbed in you when you manage to discipline your mind and your senses. Okay, now we come to the last two verses of this chapter 2. So Krishna has already explained the sadhanas. We have to do Karma Yoga leading to Jnana Yoga. We also have to learn to discipline our senses and our mind. Then only we get absorbed in this knowledge, we become a Sthita Prajna. Now the question is, when I become a Sthita Prajna, what happens to me now? So I am a Sthita Prajna. I am absorbed in this knowledge. I am living my life with this knowledge. So I am not disturbed by whatever is happening around me. Favorable, unfavorable, I am able to accept. But what happens now? So in verse number 71, Krishna explains further, in these two verses, the two steps that a Sthita Prajna will go through. So verse number 70 is the first step. And what is the first step of a Sthita Prajna? Krishna says here, the Sthita Prajna is one who has abandoned all the desires. Now when we talk about desires, we must understand it does not mean abandon all desires, because human beings cannot live with desires, but meaning desires that cause disturbance to my mind. That means impure desires. Having good desires is not the problem. It is the impure desires that trouble our mind. So a Sthita Prajna is one who is not attracted by all these desires in the world. They mean nothing at all to him, because he has already found the true happiness within. He is already immersed in the happiness of Atman. So one who has abandoned all desires and acts free from longing does not even expect anything. Whatever comes, I surrender that to God. What happens? He says, such a person acting in the world without attachment, without ego, he attains peace. Sa shantim adigachati. Adigachati means attains what? Shanti. What is this shanti? This shanti is what is called peace of mind. This does not mean moksha. But peace of mind only can come when we have got rid of all the impure desires. When all our actions are surrendered to God, then only comes total peace of mind. That is the state of a Sthita Prajna. So while living, he has got peace of mind. Shantim adigachati. Okay, then what happens? The last verse. In such a state of peace of mind, he says, established in that state, at the hour of death, one attains God realization. So First stage is, while living as a Sthita Prajna, we have this peace of mind because we have surrendered everything to God, and there is no ego, there is no attachment, we carry on all our duties. There is real peace of mind. Second stage is, upon death, he says, Brahma Nirvanam Richati. He attains Brahma Nirvanam. Now that is what is called moksha. And why is that moksha attained? If you remember the three karmas which I explained to you last time, the three karmas, what are the three karmas that govern our lives? Samchit karma and Prarabdha karma. Prarabdha karma and Agami karma. So, to a Sthita Prajna, while you are living, you are not creating any new Agami karmas. That means Agami karmas are the fresh karmas we create. Why do we create these karmas? As long as we act out of attachment, we act out of ego, we create new karmas in this life itself. Already we have come with a lot of karmas. Not enough, we create some more karmas. So what happens to these Agami karmas? They go into our Sanchita karma, which is our warehouse of karmas. Positive and negative. All the papam and punyam are there. Okay? So to the Sthita Prajna, Sanchita karmas are still there. Agami karmas, fresh karmas in this life, he does not create. But he has to wait for his death until the Prarabdha karmas, which is operative in this life, the current karmas which he carried forward, which he was born, on the day he was born, these Prarabdha karmas were effective and they will only be exhausted when he. So when the Prarabdha karmas are exhausted, he dies. So Prarabdha karmas are burnt off. That's why a Jnani like Ramakrishna also suffered cancer. Because why? It was not due to his Agami karmas. It is due to his Prarabdha karmas. So Prarabdha karmas end at time of death. Agami fresh karmas are not formed. And why does this Sthita Prajna achieve moksha at the time of death? Because for a Sthita Prajna, God takes away all his Sanchita karmas. Only God can burn away all your Sanchita karmas. Why would God do that? Because in this life, if you reach the state of a Sthita Prajna, therefore all your Sanchita karmas are burned away. That's why these great Mahatmas, when they die, they do not cremate the body. Generally, in those days, they used to take the body and throw it into the sea. Because they say, let the fishes enjoy. There is no more reason for this body. There are no prayers, there are no rituals, there are no rites to be done. The body is just a piece of flesh. And that's why they call it samadhi. Or either they put them in a, what you call that? State of samadhi, and they make a kind of a statue or something out of that. So the bodies are no use already. There's no need to do rites and prayers because he is not going to go on further already. So that is the state, Brahma Nirvanam Richati. There are no more karmas for this person to be reborn. And thus, life comes to an end. And that ends chapter 2. Now, are there any questions? Are there a lot? I mean, I don't know how many questions there are. Are there a lot of questions or few questions?
Is Nirvana and Brahmic state the same? Is it same?
Actually, here he says, such is the Brahmic state. Yeah, when you reach Brahman Nirvanam, that is called the state of Brahman. That means you and Brahman are one. You are merged with Brahman. There is no difference. It is just like this body, this bottle represents this body. The air in the bottle, when this bottle breaks, what happens to the air in the bottle? It merges with the air outside. There is no difference at all. So that is reaching that state of Brahmic state. Any more questions? Okay, if not, we will end this session and we come up. You have a question? Huh? Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, let me turn this off. Just you want to discuss about that Chinese New Year thing, right? Okay, on the 12th, the next class is on the 12th of February, and then we have another class on the